Nigeria has a terrible history with international oil companies like Shell, having a hard time getting compensation for environmental damage. Even with some legal wins, like when the Hague Court of Appeals found Shell Nigeria liable for damages from pipeline leaks in the villages of Oruma and Goi, the country is still a long way from achieving true justice. To add salt to the injury, the violators have themselves gone on to sue Nigeria, sometimes using domestic law, but in the greater number of cases, resorting to investor-state dispute settlement clauses in bilateral investment treaties that Nigeria is signed to. As a result of these cases, where costs to citizens have run into billions of dollars, Nigeria has become critical of the current international arbitration system and has since announced that it will revise all bilateral investment treaties, BITs, signed between 1990 and 2001. They plan to renegotiate 12 of the 15 BITs that are currently in force. However, at the same time, Nigeria has already completed the first three steps of joining the Energy Charter Treaty, the ECT. This treaty is frequently used by fossil fuel companies to sue countries when they try to enact environmentally friendly policies. History shows that, though the Energy Charter Treaty makes many promises of burgeoning investment, the reality is that it doesn't significantly improve investment prospects. Instead, the ECT's investor-state dispute settlement provisions give foreign investors in the energy sector sweeping rights to directly sue states in international tribunals of three private lawyers called arbitrators. Companies can be awarded dizzying sums in compensation for government actions that have allegedly damaged their investments. When you consider that nearly all ISDS cases against Nigeria so far are already linked to the exploitation and selling of oil or gas, and couple this with the importance of the energy sector to Nigeria's economy, it's easy to see the risk the country could face. If Nigeria joins the Energy Charter Treaty, the effort to critically assess its current investment treaties seems rather futile. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're concerned with power, how it can be generated in a fair and equitable manner without endangering the planet or livelihoods. In many of the countries that are in the process of acceding to the ECT, hardly anyone seems to have even heard of the agreement, let alone have thoroughly examined its political, legal, and financial risks. And even with the supposed modernization process, which is supposed to deal with the problematic clauses in the treaty, it continues to threaten to bind yet more countries to corporate-friendly energy policies. Why are African countries like Nigeria drawn to the ECT, when the treaty has such obvious grave implications for their ability to determine their own internal policies? What is the broader context that informs this seemingly contradictory behavior? To understand what is happening with the Energy Charter Treaty in West Africa, and particularly in the region's biggest country by population and economy, Nigeria, I spoke to Obeko Daniel. Daniel works as a tax and trade organizer for Public Services International, which is the Global Union Federation of Workers in Public Services. Currently based in Accra, Daniel also coordinates PSI's project on digitalization in the region. I began with a bit of a broad question. African governments are elected to act according to the will of the people. But in light of this unbridled power transnational corporations seem to wield, do they actually have the sovereignty to determine all their domestic policies? What happens when that will is subverted?
Thank you very much, Sean. I think that in terms of the freedom to determine our policies and run with our policies, there are difficulties in owning our policies. One, because we find ourselves as a continent in a very globalized world. A globalized world whose policies are very neoliberal, open, free market oriented, and in a very capitalist structure. And so in terms of owning our policy space, I think it's very difficult. It's also very difficult because of the international nature of finance. finance these days has what it takes to move from one location to the other. So in another sense, finance has become very transnational. And so that makes it difficult for us to own our policy space, whether we are talking about the climate, whether we are talking about trade, whether we are talking about tax governance, whether we are talking about labor, including some cultural and social issues. And so in terms of the ownership of our policies, I find it difficult to respond that we do own our policies, because in situations where we seem to be owning our policies, what we see is that these policies that are drafted are actually drafted with the sponsorship of multinational companies that are drafted with sponsorship from some development agencies. And so it makes it difficult for us to own our policy space. Of course, in terms of development of the policies themselves, we have experts who sit on negotiation tables to help us develop our policies. But in terms of ownership, I think that is extremely difficult because of how globalized the world has become, the power of capital, and the neoliberal policies that are scattered all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself work particularly in the trade arena, right?
Right.
And how has this lack of flexibility or lack of policy ownership expressed itself in the work that you do? How have you seen it firsthand?
Right. This is where I would bring up the issue of bilateral investment treaties. I think that in terms of trade, what we see, if you look at the free trade agreements, for example, the free trade agreement the EU has with some African countries and the region, you have trade that is liberalized between the two regions, that is EU and some African countries. But the challenge we face is that because we have liberalized an economy, we have liberalized a partner who offers incentives to, for example, its farmers. Well, a typical example is the issue of poultry. So the continent has the challenge where poultry is dumped into the onto the continent from EU countries. And because farmers in EU are highly subsidized, unfortunately, the EU and other partners are telling African countries not to subsidize its farmers. And so it makes it difficult for the poultry industry in Africa to compete with the poultry industry in Europe. Another example.
So African countries are being asked to operate by rules that their competitors are not themselves operating by.
Right. That's the situation. Another example is what guides investment or what guides investors in the region. And so the continent and the region has signed up to investment treaties with other countries, for example, Ghana and the Netherlands, Ghana and Mauritius, Ghana and the US, Ghana and the UK, and including other African countries who have signed bilateral investment treaties. And in these treaties is what we call the investor state dispute resolution system, because the investors are particular about their investment. And so they are seeking ways to protect their investment. And one way of protecting their investment is, according to them, if, for example, a government takes a policy decision that threatens their ability to make profit, what they do is to sue the government. Unfortunately, they sue these governments in a system or in a regime that is outside their jurisdiction. So for example, if a company that is based or whose registration is based in the Netherlands, because Ghana has a bilateral investment treaty with the Netherlands, if the company that is based in Netherlands, the ability of this company is threatened in terms of profit making, the company has the right to sue the government of Ghana in an arbitration system that is outside the confines or outside the jurisdiction of Ghana.
So a company comes from the Netherlands, signs a deal with Ghana and says, we're going to pursue this business that's going to give this much value
in
for
profit.
The country, for the in profit for the country of Ghana.
Right.
And then if Ghana does anything that goes against that business, then that company sues. What is in it for Ghana then?
One of the issues I mentioned earlier was the fact that the world has become very globalized. Finance has also become very globalized and very transnational. And so in a number of developing countries, the agenda or the policy direction is to attract foreign direct investment. And so if government is reforming labor, it is doing so to be able to attract foreign direct investment. If government is providing tax incentives to multinational companies in the mining sector in Africa or in the mining sector in developing countries, if they are granting tax waivers to companies in the energy sector, what they are basically doing is to attract foreign direct investment. And by doing that, these investors are also interested in the natural resources of these countries. And so they come in, and so for us as developing countries, what is assumed to be in for us is creation of employment, attracting foreign direct investment, and possibly the transfer of technology.
So, in an ideal situation,
Right.
African countries provide natural resources, which they have an
Right.
abundance of, and
Right.
then these foreign investors bring in technology, they bring
Right.
in finance, they bring
Right.
in, I guess, state-of-the-art
Right.
knowledge systems
Right.
that then mutually benefit both the company and the countries.
Right.
But that's not what's happening.
That's not what's happening. And so, as far as the ISDS is concerned, what countries are faced with is that if the company feels that the government has taken a policy decision, for example, if government of Ghana decides to phase out fossil fuel in the economy of Ghana, and there is a fossil fuel company based in Ghana, operating in Ghana, and it feels that phasing out fossil fuel will threaten its ability to make profit, it will sue the government of Ghana in an arbitration system that is outside the jurisdiction of Ghana.
A country finds itself equal in a way
Right,
to a
right,
transnational company,
right.
and they both become subjected to a separate justice system
Right,
that's got nothing to do with the country's justice
right,
system at all.
right, right.
It sounds ridiculous to me. It's not the first time I've heard this, but every time
Right,
I hear it, it keeps
right,
striking me that, okay, this just does not make sense, because
right.
especially if you're equating a country to a company,
Right, right,
that's an
right.
absurdity in the system.
It's actually ridiculous in a sense that
Yeah.
one, what it means is that it downplays the judicial system of that country. What it also does is that it limits the policy space within which government and civil society organizations and trade unions can engage. Because once the policy space is closed, or once they are limiting government's ability to make policy changes, it means it closes the policy space. And for us, this is extremely ridiculous. It's actually a threat to the sovereignty of these countries to not have the ability to address its own issues domestically. One.
So this country, the companies get a foot in the door essentially,
Right.
and the moment you try to change anything, you're stuck because you're going to
Right.
be sued, and it's going to cost a
Right.
lot of money to get
Right.
out of that system.
Right. Another aspect you can look at in terms of how absurd and how ridiculous this situation is that these cases are superintended by arbitrators who are declared independent, but these are arbitrators with interests. One, how long they are paid based on the number of hours they spend on the cases. And so there's motivation to prolong the process. Two, there are cases where these arbitrators, in fact, most of the cases, arbitrators either have worked for these companies before, or in one way or the other, have dealings with the company, which may jeopardize how independent the rulings are. And for us, we think that these are some of the things that make the whole process ridiculous and absurd.
So somebody is an expert in a field.
Right.
I'm always curious about how the arbitrators get chosen, right? So it's
Right,
because
right.
they're experts in a field, but that's
Right.
usually because they've worked for these organizations and
Right.
understand them very well. But
Yes.
also it means they've created connections. They
Right.
know the CEO, they're familiar
Right.
with
Right.
the company's board, and then they're
Right.
supposed to now come and independently arbitrate in a situation where the company is in a dispute with the country.
Right.
But why don't African countries pull out of these investment? Because what I'm seeing is, instead of a collective pulling out from these
Right.
bilateral investment treaties that are
Right.
causing such problems, what I'm
Right.
seeing instead, I'm from Zimbabwe, And when I look at the news, it's every other day there's an announcement of a big investment deal where this new company is going to come and mine granite. This new company is going to come and do ABC. We just discovered oil in Muzarabani. Right. So now a big company is going to be drilling for oil. And these are all celebrated, right?
These
investment treaties. And at no point in the press or in the media do you hear about the dangers, this problem of being sued. It's coming up now in a few cases.
Right.
But what is stopping African countries from recognizing this danger and from acting on it? What, in your opinion, stands in the way?
In my opinion, it's more about the political will. And so, for example, there is a case where the treaty between Tanzania and the Netherlands ended, or the treaty expired, let me put it that way. Tanzania decided not to renew. Yeah. Of course, it was faced with some challenges, but it stood its ground. That is one. The other thing is that we have some good stories in the continent. So, for example, Nigeria, through its Investment Promotion Commission, is reforming BITs that has ISDS. One of the issues they are looking at is to make sure that domestic judicial systems or domestic systems of trade arbitration are completely used before these companies can resort to international arbitration.
So they're creating internal capacity in the judicial system to deal with arbitration cases.
Fantastic. The AU as well has what it called a model bilateral investment treaty, where it advises governments to ensure that it capacitates its local judicial system, including other local institutions, to ensure that all those domestic institutions are utilized before resorting to international arbitration.
So that has not always been the case.
Right.
Has it been that the moment there's a dispute, they jump to the international arena and
that's the case. Arbitration? That's it.
Yeah.
So countries have the right to discontinue or not to renew bilateral investment treaties when their time elapsed. And yes, of course, in spite of the challenges, they have their rights and they can do that. I know that Tanzania has done that. South Africa has done a number of them. Again, they have also the right to start domestic reforms at their country level to ensure that bilateral investment treaties are reformed. So for example, the Nigeria case I mentioned, they use that local model to develop a BIT between Nigeria and Morocco. We also know that these countries are part of the UN trade development system, where they have the opportunity to make their cases clear in terms of how they want the ISDS to be reformed. There are a number of steps that I've taken to reform the ISDS, but it does not touch the main issues that developing countries are particular about. And that has to do with the ISDS. That has to do with the use of domestic judicial systems to address conflicts or disputes.
So that's really great. If a country like Nigeria, which is a huge economy and trades with so many countries, if they're taking time to say, okay, let's review our investment treaties, let's look at those clauses that we don't want in these agreements going forward.
Right.
That sounds to me like, okay, so there's a recognition of the problem and there are some steps being taken to mitigate the problem.
Fantastic.
But at the same time, I've been reading up a lot on the Energy Charter Treaty, for instance.
Right.
Nigeria, being an oil producer, being a country that has quite a big role to play in the energy transition, I think, in Africa.
Right.
Seems to be in the crosshairs of the Secretariat of the Energy Charter Treaty.
Right.
Does it look like they're going to be joining the Energy Charter Treaty?
I think Nigeria is a very interesting situation. One, because is I think one of the largest economy in the continent with a population of over 200 million. Again, Nigeria also has energy problems in electricity. So, for example, it's not able to supply 24/7 electricity to its citizens. So that's an issue. Then the other thing is that Nigeria is among the largest oil producing countries in the continent. So Nigeria's situation is very, very interesting. But then we need to look at, I mean, what the ECT is all about and why they are so much interested in Africa and in particular Nigeria. The ECT basically was developed to as an energy governance framework for Europe. So linking Western Europe, Eastern Europe to address the issue of the differences in the energy supply, to provide energy security in terms of the countries that are involved in the framework. And the third aspect is, you know, has to do with investment. And so, for example, there's need for European money to move from one European country, say, for example, Western Europe into Eastern Europe to invest. And once there is investment, there's need for protection. The reason why the ECT is targeting developing countries and in particular Nigeria, one has to do with the fact that there is investment, and those investment or those monies must find countries where it can invest. And they are looking at investing in countries where there is fossil fuel, there's energy, there's electricity, and all that. But we also have to know, we have to also take note of the fact that because of the EU's involvement in the climate discussion, in energy transition, they are gradually going to phase out fossil fuel, and they are gradually going to make a lot of reforms as far as their energy sector is concerned. And so those investments that are abundant in Europe must find where to invest, and Africa and developing countries are the targets, and Nigeria in particular, because of the market, because of the economy, because of its economic challenges, Nigeria has become a target. And so what we see, or what we have seen over the period, is the ECT Secretariat having a lot of engagement with Nigeria, and in particular they are targeting the Energy Commission of Nigeria, and it has to do with the need for them to find areas where they can invest. And the challenge we have with this whole process is the fact that the ECT has an ISDS provision.
This is an angle I had not heard before, and now hearing it makes sense, right? Because the possibilities for energy companies in Europe are dwindling, because the energy transition is in progress in some way. There's less appetite for fossil fuels. There's less appetite for what these big companies have been investing in. Money needs to go somewhere. So they'll go where the restrictions are not as tight as they are in Europe. And where is that going to be? It's going to be the global south. It's going to be in Africa. And that explains, I think, why you've got all these countries now being coaxed by the ECT to jump on board. But that wouldn't be a good idea for Nigeria to join the ECT, right? It's got ISDS provisions in it, and that's just asking to be sued.
And I think that is not good for Nigeria, because on one hand, you have the Investment Promotion Commission reforming bilateral investment treaties that has ISDS. And they are looking at making sure that when there are disputes, they are resolved domestically. And then on the other hand, you have the Energy Commission engaging the ECT Secretariat. And it's not just the Energy Commission, the Justice Ministry and other ministries, they are working together to engage the ECT. So we find the whole process counterproductive and in like a zero-sum game, because on one hand, there is reform, and because the commission identifies the challenges with ISDS. And then on the other hand, the other commission, which is the Energy Commission, is engaging a framework that has ISDS. And we find that very challenging. And why it's another point to also consider is how much countries lose when they are, you know, slapped with penalties during these disputes. So, for example, in Nigeria over the years, if you recount how much Nigeria has lost in terms of ISDS cases, is running into billions of US dollars.
Wow, this is money that Nigeria has had to pay to these companies?
Indeed.
Or is it also the cost of the lawsuit itself?
So there is the cost of the lawsuits, and then how much Nigeria has to pay after the case is ruled. And here we are talking about how much Nigeria has to pay.
That's in right. billions.
Right, right. And what
Nigeria could use those billions, man.
Indeed, indeed. And we are talking about an economy where quality public health delivery is a problem,
mm-hmm.
where quality public education is a problem. As we are speaking now, university teachers as a union are on strike. They have been on strike for more than 4 months.
Wow.
And it has to do with their conditions of service. And so you can't have a country like Nigeria, you know, losing these amounts of money to arbitration, losing these amounts of money to ISDS. And so it's among the reason why Nigeria's situation has become very critical and has become one of the issues that we are very much interested in.
Who has received this money? Do you have some examples of like which companies and from which countries they are that have been receiving this money from Nigeria?
So some of the companies we have Shell, which I mean over the years has had its own issues with Nigeria. Mm-hmm. We have Shell. We have Eni International, which has had its own issues in Nigeria. And interestingly, there is also a Chinese company known as Zhongshan. Which is engaged in the what we call the free zones area in Nigeria, or the free zones enclave in Nigeria, which has also sued the Republic of Nigeria. So these are some of the big companies that have sued the Republic of Nigeria as far as ISDS is concerned. And in most of the cases, they are all having to do with the Nigeria's government's ability to change a decision or to make a U-turn regarding a decision, considering the impact of those decisions on the public and the citizenry.
Mm-hmm. So that's the regulatory chill people keep talking about.
Right.
Then countries are unable to change anything once they're sort of locked into these agreements.
No.
It sounds to me like a situation that's difficult to get out of, because I think countries had a whole raft of treaties and agreements that they signed up to, right? Because I think it's been a while now that the conversation has been, you need foreign direct investment, you need to attract investors.
Right.
And then you attract investors, you sign, and then all of a sudden you find that you're in trouble if you want to change anything.
Right.
So in your opinion, you're working with PSI, you've worked with civil society organizations from across the continent. Where is the wiggle room? Where is the space for achieving some sort of change? And how can ordinary folks that are maybe listening to this podcast, or young scholars that are at university that are trying to figure out how to participate, what can be done about this situation?
Right. I think in looking at what can be done, we first have to look at government, then we move on to other civil society organizations. I think that we need to look at what others have already done. And so one is to ensure that if you have a bilateral investment treaty or in a trade agreement, which has ISDS, when the time elapsed, you just decide, don't renew. It's as simple as that. You don't have to renew. Yeah. The second thing is for government itself to recognize how challenging ISDS cases are, and how it's a drain on its own coffers, and so should begin a process of reform. And again, others have begun, just like in Nigeria. We should, as countries or as developing countries, should begin a reform process to eliminate ISDS in our various bilateral investment treaties. The third is to work with the AU, looking at its own bilateral investment treaty models to ensure that it does not reduce the power of the states to regulate, and that we must take a learning from that. In terms of civil society organizations, one of the things we realized was that we do not have enough civil society organizations and unions that are aware of this situation, including CSOs and unions that are involved in the discussions around, or the conversations around energy transition and climate change. And so we need all these organizations to be involved in the discussion, because that is where the money is. And that is where countries are locked into all kinds of agreements, are locked into all kinds of positions that makes it difficult for them to come out of that. For academics who are involved, I think that what we need to do is to reach out to ourselves. Here, I mean CSOs reaching out to academics, academics reaching out to CSOs, and take advantage of their skills in terms of, you know, analyzing in monetary terms how much countries are losing, because we need to quantify all these losses in monetary terms and quantify them in terms of investment in public services, investment in schools, investment in healthcare, investment in energy, investment in roads and other social amenities. It is when we are able to quantify these losses into some of these practical needs of society that we can have the conversations, you know, being received at the national level. We also need to ensure that the media is involved. In most cases, we begin these discussions and then we bring the media in the discussions very, very late. And I think that we need to, you know, start bringing them or making them part of the process from the beginning.
Indeed, yeah, I think there has to be a much broader understanding of these issues. Every time I speak to folks back home, and they celebrate these deals. I think now that there's a bit of a skepticism. People think, oh, it's only the big shots that are getting paid. But I think the deeper problem is not being analyzed, which is that it's mortgaging the country's future.
Right.
It's putting the future at risk, essentially, because some of these agreements are decades long.
Or just by way of information, we are still interested in the Nigeria situation, and so we are planning series of activities in Nigeria to get the attention the issue deserves, and we are hopeful that Nigeria as a country will not accede to the ACT, because if Nigeria accedes, it serves as a template to a number of countries in the region. And that is what we must work to avoid. And because Nigeria, by its, you know, as a country, is cognizant of the fact that ISDS is problematic, and so is embarking on reforms. And so we do not see why Nigeria will accede to the ACT.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. This has been.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. This was a conversation with Obeko Daniel, who works as a tax and trade organizer for Public Services International, which is the Global Union Federation of Workers in Public Services. PSI, together with partners, is organizing a series of activities to prevent Nigeria from joining the ECT. If you're in the country and able to participate, please check the PSI webpage linked in the description for more details. If we are to change the world and make things more just, equitable, and fair, we need to understand how things work, how those in power maintain that power, and what are the pillars that support them. At TNI, we have built an entire archive of research on the Energy Charter Treaty and more broadly on investor-state dispute settlement. We invite you to explore it and to use it to get a better grasp of the factors that shape the world we live in. In fact, the latest addition to this archive is a report on ISDS in Nigeria, which is linked in the podcast description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and see you next time.